So our next case is appeal number 21-1321, American National versus Sleep Number Corporation. Mr. Elliott, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This appeal relates to similar claims of two related patents. Unfortunately, the board found the skills of the PCETA, having a four-year engineering degree and multiple years of experience with programming and in the industry, unable to perform basic high school math and unable to substitute a simple multiplicative offset taught by the Ebel reference into a previously accepted combination, including a general offset or adjustment factor. That is, claim one, for example, of either patent, broadly claims an adjustment factor and is silent as to the type of offset for that adjustment factor. Ebel teaches both additive offsets and multiplicative offsets for error adjustment. In referring to page 27 of the blue brief, it explains these concepts with the substantially same graph used by Sleep Number in the 154 and 747 patents. You can see the side-by-side comparison of Ebel's figure 3A with figure 4 of the challenge patents. That Ebel clearly demonstrates the graphical and mathematical relationship between the measured pressure and the remote actual pressure during the inflation and deflation. And Ebel uses an additive offset to determine the bag pressure during inflation and a multiplicative offset during deflation, just like the challenged patents. The board's purported struggle here is that Ebel's multiplicative offset is applied to a measured pressure to determine the actual pressure, not to calculate a target pressure. But A&M has already asserted, and the board had already found, that it was obvious in view of the Gift-Mitol-Pillsbury combination to use an offset to calculate a target pressure.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Why isn't the board's finding supported by substantial evidence? For example, the other references seem to be directed towards computing a target pressure in one place based on the measurement of pressure in a different place, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Ebel's not directed to that problem. Instead, it's measuring pressure in a single place. I think that's part of the board's reasoning here for why it would have been obvious to combine Ebel with the other references.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't that sufficient substantial evidence?
It ignores the structure of the claims. The structure of claim one is agnostic as to the type of offset, whether multiplicative, whether additive, or even an integral. You could go to a higher level function. Claim one is just an adjustment factor. Okay? And so we established, and the board agreed with us, that it was obvious to use it's obvious to use any offset, okay, to calculate a target pressure. All Ebel had to do then, and all the person of ordinary skill in the art had to do then, was take the multiplicative offset, as taught by Ebel, and use it in a deflation context.
I guess my question is, thinking about the standard of review again,
sure,
substantial evidence, I understand it feels like you're re-arguing a factual question that the board already decided and which the board has support for its decision. So that's why I'm struggling.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor is correct, of course, that what the board pointed to is that difference, and I had even said it right as your question came up, that what Ebel does is it applies that multiplicative offset in order to calculate what the actual pressure is in that remote air chamber. And so what we had already established, though, with the structure of the claims, is that it's obvious to use an offset, okay, to correct for error between the two. And it's obvious to use that offset in order to calculate a target pressure. And so all you really have to do, again, is take that multiplicative offset and plug it in for, in the case of Mitol, an additive offset. In the case of Pillsbury, a subtractive, which would also be additive, a subtractive offset on deflation. And so that's the board's reasoning that missed that particular point of how these claims are structured.
Does your petition include a specific reason for why you would add Ebel to the three reference combination?
Yes, it does. And so when you look at Ebel and the explanation that was provided in the context of Claim 1, starting there, and we'll use Claim 1 and Claim 5 as our examples. In the context of Claim 1, you look at appendices sites 930 through 932, and then more specific to the direct limitations, 942 to 946. Those are for claim one. And then when you jump to claim five, and claim five expressly incorporated the argument from claim one into it, and so the appendix sites there would be 960 through 963 for claim five, to use the multiplicative offsets to calculate the target pressure. I sense more questions coming, but I'll go on to another topic until you're ready with them. Sleep Number claims that the board wrongfully switched the burden of proving the claims invalid from American National to Sleep Number and placed the burden on Sleep Number to disprove American National's assertions of invalidity. This is a clear attempt to recharacterize the board's factual findings here regarding the prior art.
Are you addressing the cross-appeal issues now?
Yes.
I think you have to wait.
What's that?
Are you able to address those at this point? I don't think you are. I think you have to wait. Mr. Cordell gets to address those.
Okay. Let me shift topics.
We're just talking about your appeal right now.
So the board has also committed error in allowing a trial within a trial, making determinations regarding infringement. This error was compounded by instructing American National not to respond to infringement contentions, which were also wrongfully incorporated by reference by Sleep Number in violation of Board Rule 42.6A3. Then, after instructing American National not to submit anything in response to the contention, the board finds a weak nexus established in part because of the unrebutted infringement contentions. Your Honors,
may I be able to even address this issue since you ultimately did win on this issue?
Yep,
for obviousness?
That was exactly my next comment. Your Honors may view this point as moot. However, the cross-appeal does also put this into play, and there is a continuing harm to American National. Were we to return to district court, we're going to spend thousands upon thousands of dollars arguing evidentiarily to omit this particular material from evidence on that record. The other thing that's pointed to is that American National allegedly didn't even contend that these infringement contentions are wrong, and that's inaccurate. In our briefs opposing this...
Just to be clear, it's really not infringement contentions. It's reading on for the purposes of showing nexus for commercial success. And the board actually corrected its opinion on that issue, right?
Right. The board, yes, that's correct.
Okay. That should be abundantly clear. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it was a finding on infringement.
Well, so I struggle with the distinction between infringement and reading on. I think we all do.
I think to your benefit in district court, you should say it's not a finding on infringement. I don't know why you wouldn't.
Well, I think we certainly can say that, but the problem is that it's going to be they're trying to get into evidence that it reads on, and maybe the original decision did say infringement, which we did ask them to correct on rehearing.
Isn't it different because there's different evidence being presented and such? I don't know how much time you want to waste on whether it's infringement or reading on, but it seems to me it would probably be improper for us to address it, given that you won on the issue of obviousness.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's somewhat similar to the pressure means that Sleep Number is in the previous case. Let me make one other point on this, though, and that is that A&M did represent in its briefs in opposition to the discovery that the issue of infringement are highly contested, and patent owners' infringement contentions are deficient, vague, and ambiguous, and raise issues of practicing the prior art. And you can see the cites to our briefs at 3203 in the appendix and 3219 in the appendix. Still further, the board permitted improper amendments to the claims that were not directly permissible under Section 102 and 103. Specifically, the board allowed amendment of the claims to incorporate subject matter from a prior patent, which is incorporated by reference, to bolster the claims against future Section 112 infringement arguments.
Do you agree that the amendments were made, they also, even if there were additional changes that were made to address other issues, the amendments were made in response to a ground of unpatentability?
Some of the amendments to the claims were, yes. Those claims added the multiplicative offset to them to overcome the evil reference. So yes, there were 102 and 103 amendments present. What we're taking contention with was the allowance of Section 112 amendments also being put in there.
And you read the PTO's regulation as restricting the amendment to one specific purpose.
Yes, that being for 102 and 103. And if you look at the difference between our old inter-parties reexamination and what we have now with the inter-parties review, the inter-parties reexamination, you could amend claims to take on Section 112, and you also had, and this is important here, the ability to amend the specification under the regs under the inter-parties reexamination. There's no regulations permitting the amendment of the specification here. And when you go back and you look at like the original examination of a patent, if you're going to take something from an incorporation by reference and you're going to put it in there, you've got to get that material into your specification. And that's provided under CFR 1.75D1 for the specification and 1.83A for the drawings. We addressed section 1.83 in our oppositions to the MTA and in the blue brief at page 73. So the rules addressing initial examination permit incorporation material by reference, but insertion of material into the claims is going to be required to be admitted into the spec and if need be the drawings. And there's just no provision to do that in the context of the inter-parties review. And I see I've gone into my rebuttal time, so if I may reserve that for rebuttal.
Yes, you can reserve your time. Okay. When you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The Director intervened on just two issues in this appeal. First is A&M's statutory and constitutional challenge to a sentence in the Board's nexus decision. In that first issue, A&M was the prevailing party on secondary considerations, and they admit that their challenge does not seek to reverse or alter the Board's judgment in any way. Accordingly, under this Court's Skyhawk decision, they're just not dissatisfied with the decision in the context of the appellate statute. So we'd ask that this Court not entertain that challenge.
Would you address the other issue, which is whether amendments may be made, that even though the primary amendment relates to overcoming prior art, there's additional changes made that the PTO could see were related to written description and other issues?
Of course, Your Honor. First, we say this challenge is forfeited because A&M did not present this challenge to the Board, so the Board didn't address it. But the regulation does not limit amendments only to amendments that address a ground of unpatentability in the trial. It says that the amendment may be denied if the amendments do not address a ground of unpatentability in the trial. And I hear A&M admitting that some of these amendments did respond to a ground of unpatentability in the trial and not challenging that. The Board has a precedential decision interpreting its regulation that says not every change to words for an amendment have to respond to a ground of unpatentability. They may also address potential 101 and 112 issues with claims. And there's simply no requirement for the Board to police amendments by looking for possible 112 or 101 issues in the original claims before allowing a motion to amend. So if there are no questions, we would ask you not to reverse the Board's grant of the motion to amend based on outside of its regulatory authority.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Cordell.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Ruffin Cordell for Sleep Number. In contradistinction to the last appeal, we do think the Board made a couple of errors in this case, and we think that this is an IPR that kind of got away from them, primarily in not holding A&M to its burdens in bringing the IPR petition in the first instance. So we've seen through this appeal several instances where the Board filled in gaps, rose essentially to find evidence that for whatever reason A&M didn't present, and that's really the gravamen of where we are.
One of the concerns I had relating to what you've just said is that means plus function argument under the Board's regulation. But the concern I have is this. Is your argument on cross-appeal an end run around institution? Because if the petition should have had something in it, giving an explicit definition of a means plus function term, isn't that something that would bar institution on that claim? I mean, I'm just concerned that it's an end run around institution, something that I don't have jurisdiction to consider.
Well, I make two points. Number one, it is not, because it should have been, and those issues remain all through the case. So any defect in A&M's affirmative burden presentation could be criticized during the PTAB proceedings or before this Court. And then secondly, under CUSO, I agree with you, had they denied institution, that this Court would not have jurisdiction. I have several deep wounds I can show you for having run afoul of that, but the reality is they didn't deny institution, they granted institution, and they made it to final written decision. And having done so, we can examine the bases upon which the proceeding proceeded. So CUSO doesn't tell us that you don't have jurisdiction if they went forward. It tells us you don't have jurisdiction if they denied it. And here they went forward, And importantly, the cadence of a PTAB proceeding is important. A&M comes forward with its petition, and it's supposed to have all its evidence and all its arguments right there. And this wasn't an incidental omission or oversight by A&M. It was the fundamental construction of one of the terms that ultimately was bandied about. The 474 petition has the to the extent language, where they parrot kind of, in case you come up with this construction, well, then we might have arguments about it. But that's as far as they went. In the 154 petition, they don't say anything. So I understand that this is a bit of a burden.
Same term in both. It's a little bit of a technical argument, right?
I agree with that. But the question is, are we going to obligate patent owners then to cross-reference different proceedings?
How is it that you say abuse of discretion? I mean, it's a pretty deferential standard review. Is it that you're arguing that it's kind of arbitrary to enforce the rule or not enforce the rule?
Well, yes. I mean, the reality is, again, I could show you some of those deep wounds where I have run afoul of perhaps a technical omission before the board and have been held to it. But it's important because we have very limited ability to address these issues. Right, as the patent owner, you really have one shot and then a trial to put on evidence and address what has to be addressed. And so it's important that we hold the challengers to their burdens and have them.
But the board chooses not to do so.
But again, they're supposed to follow their own rules under the APA, right? We're supposed to know kind of the evidence and arguments with which we are confronted so that we can adequately respond. But I acknowledge it's a close call, and it's within their discretion to do lots of things. But here, we think that they really should have held A&M to its proofs.
Why is it that you think that the petition doesn't address motivation to combine GIF, Mattel, and Pillsbury, and specifically to add Pillsbury? Because in looking at pages A930 to 31, it seems to me that there is some discussion of a reason for why. And it repeats, in fact, I guess, the reason that's in the board's opinion, which is about for increasing speed and accuracy of adjusting the pressure in a chamber.
So there, I think what the board ultimately did is said it's analogous and said that there are goals that are discussed in all of these references. And the board went in and looked and found those goals. What A&M should have done is they should have presented evidence in the first instance for why one of ordinary skill faced with this already somewhat extended combination of GIF and Mittal would have then looked to Pillsbury. And that's what's missing. That's what we don't have. And it's not a question where they did it poorly or didn't do it particularly well. They discussed goals. They discussed the fact that it's analogous art. But that's as far as it went.
What about the fact that Pillsbury is described, at least by one of the experts, as being more explanatory of what Mattel is teaching? In other words, it's a little bit redundant. It gives a little bit more detail, so you don't need to have another reason.
Well, remember, what Mattel taught was ranges, right? It was inflating tires, and the fundamental focus of Mattel were really broad inflation ranges, right? The orders of magnitude we're talking about with Mattel were much, much, much larger. And I would agree that Pillsbury was more apt in that it looked at perhaps the right pressure ranges and the right adjustment ranges, but we didn't have that in the petition, and we didn't have that before the board until really the final argument. And it was, once again, A&M's burden to come forward with that evidence in the first instance. They're not supposed to backfill. They're not supposed to rely on the board to become essentially super patent examiners who are looking through disclosures and finding evidence that might have been used had it been offered in the first instance. They are an adjudicated body. They are to call balls and strikes. And I acknowledge that there's a level of abstraction that has to obtain here. We can't have people file petitions that are 500 pages long. On the other hand, this is a key element, right? So Pillsbury forms every single combination that the board relied on. And that motivation to combine, it is just not there.
Is it that the board's rationale and reasoning is at a pretty high level of abstraction? It doesn't take into account that Pillsbury is talking about a blood pressure sensor and dust and determining whether it's actually using pressure measurement to determine whether there's dust on the valve.
I think that's a big part of it. I mean, when I read, I had a hard time with Pillsbury. I think that the disclosure is terse, it is confusing, and it doesn't get you pretty much to anywhere other than the idea that perhaps you're going to make an adjustment to some parameter, and it's not particularly clear about which. But setting that aside, they need to confront the fact that you wouldn't look to a blood pressure cuff, which by definition only involves one side of the inflation-deflation cycle, right? So the inflation cycle for a blood pressure cuff is just you pump it all the way up, and then the deflation cycle is where the analysis takes place. That is a wholly different animal from a mattress, which has to be tuned to the weight of a particular person or a particular, you know, environment that it sits in. A blood pressure cuff is used with hundreds of people, and the same cycle happens over and over again. The concern in Pillsbury was for a clogged filter, which I agree, Your Honor, is really sort of distracts from the overall analysis and doesn't really tell us anything. But they needed to explain that leap. They needed to explain why we would take the gift reference, which is a mattress, and we would look to a blood pressure cuff that it was concerned about a clogged filter. And had they had that evidence, we might not be having this discussion, but they didn't have it. They didn't put it in the petition, and the board didn't really find it either, ultimately.
It's a slightly different question, though. So I think, as you can probably tell, opposing counsel is really concerned about infringement. I'm wondering whether or not you're intending to argue in the district court that the board's nexus finding is somehow probative of infringement.
The answer is no. We have no such intention. We believe Skyhawk applies here just as it does in the last appeal. We tried to make that fairly clear, and as Judge Stoll points out, they didn't find infringement. They found that it reads on. And the fact that the board did an analysis that is similar to something that might happen in district court is not unusual, right? Industry praise would be used in damages analyses in district court. We have lots of those issues. So we don't think it qualifies, but to answer your question, we don't plan to argue that they were stopped, for example, in district court. I didn't really do much on my appeal other than Pillsbury, but if there are any other questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pudel. Mr. Elliott, you have a little under 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. My apologies. The first thing I'd like to address, Your Honor, is the field of the invention here. And it is inflatable objects, which includes Pillsbury. That field of the invention is stated in the patent itself, right up front in where you'd normally find in the field of invention section. Then shifting to whether what Pillsbury does and the teachings to combine in Dr. Finney's analysis, in American National's expert's analysis, he determined that the principles of these solutions could be applied to air mattresses. The specific quote is, Dr. Finney explains that a person of ordinary skill would thus realize that different applications do not affect the underlying compensation principles or the utility. In other words, these formulas and everything with the pressure controls, those are agnostic as to whether it's a 40-60 PSI system or a 0.6 PSI system such as an air mattress. Sleep Number also wants this tribunal to disturb the board's determination that the prior art teaches pressure monitoring means, alleging that the construction of the term pressure monitoring means was inadequate. However, as the court has pointed out, 37 CFR 42.104B3, cited by Sleep Number, is a gatekeeping rule. And the board's institution section, the board's institution decision is not reviewable per statute. So Sleep Number suggests, in the alternative, that including this limitation, any claims including this limitation should be held valid for this alleged failure. Again, however, the rule cited is a gatekeeping rule and does not mandate a format for construction that must be provided in order to apply prior art against a limitation. And indeed, the limitation here at issue, it is not key. The pressure sensing means is very old, very well known, and very clearly taught by all the prior art references. Taking the 172 gift patent as an example, in column 4, lines 33 through 37, it describes a pressure monitoring port 146 to receive a small tube which conveys pressure to a pressure sensor. The tube and sensor are unnumbered and unillustrated.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying, first of all, this is gatekeeping rules, so this court shouldn't consider it. But second of all, even if this court does, the answer to how this means function limitation should be construed is so clear and apparent that you didn't have to satisfy the regulation.
Not that we didn't have to satisfy it. I think the board found that we did have to satisfy it. I'm just trying to counter the emphasis that opposing counsel is putting on this as a key limitation, that it isn't, that it was easy to find exactly what this meant and what the structure was within any of the prior art references.
I get it. Okay, but how did you satisfy the regulation?
So if you look to your appendix sites for the constructions that were provided, appendix.
And specifically for, I understand that to the extent that language, mm-hmm. I'm talking about the other IPR. That's the one I have more concerns about.
Okay. Well, let me give you the sites I've got, and if they're not directed to that IPR, I'll have to provide those sites to you at a later time, Your Honor. The appendix sites that I have are 955, 312, and then 910, then 307, 1132, and 1226.
And these are sites to your petition?
These are sites to the petition and to, I believe, supporting material in the other documents.
Mr. Elliott, I'm going to give you 2 more minutes because I'm going to give Mr. Cradell 2 more minutes since we've asked a lot of questions. So if you want to address anything else, please go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Shifting to Pillsbury again, while Sleep Number asserts that American National failed to indicate the role Pillsbury plays, American National clearly states that Pillsbury teaches updating the offset to determine a target pressure and expressly calculating the error in the pressure adjustment factor. You can see this in the discussion of the combination at Appendix 942 through 946 and 1008 through 1011. Sleep Number criticizes the petition for not providing a reason to use Pillsbury, but they are merely re-arguing the failed position before the board, which you can see in the board's final written decision at Appendix 63 through 65 and for the other IPR at 208 through 210. Sleep Number is taking liberty with some deposition sound bites that the expert recited and ignores the statements in the petition that the board recognized in their final written decision. And indeed, the final written decision notes that even Sleep Number agree or Sleep Number argues that Pillsbury explicitly calculates an error. And then the board goes on to recite.
Can I ask you, looking at Pillsbury and its disclosure where it talks about, you know, you want to determine if there's an offset, you will use that offset value. That offset value will be indicative of large resistances in a pneumatic system. And it talks about determining using that, as I understand it, maybe I'm misreading the reference, but to figure out if there's dust and different things on maybe the valve. How do you respond to that? Why the board's analysis is at a level of abstraction that doesn't really deal with this issue of whether it's what this reference is teaching.
So what the reference is teaching is that the system changes over time. You do, as discussed earlier, you get dust buildup. And so that changes the resistance. And so Pillsbury teaches using an offset in order to compensate for that adjustment over time. And so it's teaching exactly what the 154 and 747 patents are approaching, and that is, how do I compensate for a system that can change over time? You're going to get dust in any system because you're pulling air from the ambient. And so it does change over time. In the case of a mattress, you also might have the mattress articulated in a given point, and that articulation is also going to change the system, and so the system would have to adjust for that.
You're out of time. Do you have anything, one sentence maybe, that you want to make to wrap it up?
Just on the burden of proof on invalidity, if I may, this was an attempt to recharacterize.
Just one sentence.
Okay. This was an attempt to recharacterize the board's actual findings regarding the prior art, which were reviewed for substantial evidence. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Would you please give Mr. Cradell 2 minutes? Thank you.
May it please the court. Returning to Pillsbury, I mean, the fundamental problem that we have with much of what the board did is that motivation to combine is not a lesser included offense. There needs to be specific evidence and argument that tells us why we would look to a clogged filter blood pressure cuff to modify the basic combination. Why we would look to a sensor error patent like an Eagle to decide that we would use it to adjust a situation where we're reducing pressure at a enclosure with in a mattress that is extended over tubes and other pneumatic resistive devices.
What's your response to his field of invention argument that he just made a few minutes ago?
You know, the field of the invention is part of it. I mean, I wouldn't, if he had been looking to, the jet engines or something, then I would say that would be a bigger problem. But that's not enough. So the fact that his expert says, well, you know, if you're inflating something, you're always inflating something, no matter what it is. This art has got too many different options in it. This is not one that's where the field is that nascent. And so when we're talking about combining a mattress with tire inflation, with remote sensor versus local sensor error correction, and then now we're going to a remote, blood pressure cuff with clogged air filters, there are leaps there that need to be explained, and they need to be addressed. So I acknowledge that I have a substantial evidence burden in attacking this, but the reality is there should have been some evidence. They should have explained to us why one of ordinary skill in the art would say, oh, blood pressure cuffs, of course. That's where you would go for this kind of an invention, this kind of analysis. And that's just missing. So it's really not a question of substantial evidence, there's really just no evidence. And if I could make one last point, Your Honor, I went through counsel's recitations of the appendix, and only one of them, I think 1226, relates to the 154 patent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the good quality argument. We appreciate it. The cases are submitted on the record.